Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Today is Friday, February 7th. What a February so far, huh? What you're about to hear is a new Friday feature. Every Friday, this is going to happen. The goal. I want more people to hear some of what we do for our supporting listeners. Right now, there are four Serial bonus productions. Serial with an S. Bonus productions. And one of the things that I am most proud of, in fact, I put the entire previous episode of this series up for free, is a show that I do with my friend Dutch. You might remember Dutch from the series we did, the three-part series called Cine Manufacturing. When that series ended, man, did I want to continue the conversation, and we found a way to do that, spinning it into a film analysis show called The Picture of the Month Club. We have done four so far. The first one was on Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, the second on Martin Scorsese's The King of Comedy, the third, which you probably heard, was on Mad Max Fury Road, and this fourth one is on the 2000 film American Psycho. In every episode, I write that The Picture of the Month Club is a monthly series featuring Dutch, a delightful, I mean, let's face it, this guy is a delight, insightful, you'll hear that today. I think he has some great analysis of all the films we've done, lots of things that didn't even occur to me, and successful filmmaker, this is what he does for work, who wants to teach you the grammar and logic of cinema, the language of cinema and storytelling, and that's what we do. So every Friday in this feed from now on, I will post a snip that I am confident will entertain you, that I am confident will be worth your listening time, which I know is very precious, of one of these productions that we do, The Discomfort Zone, In Pursuit of Utopia, Picture of the Month Club, or in some cases, even older bonus content. Today's snip is a little longer than I think these will be in the future. It is the full first half hour of a 90-minute show, and that's just because, man, I didn't want to cut it off. But when it does cut off, abruptly, a half an hour from now, there are instructions you can follow if you want to immediately start listening to the remaining hour of this discussion and this gem of a production. Here we go.
You like Huey Lewis on the news?
They're okay.
Their early work was a little too new wave for my taste. But when Sports came out in 83, I think they really came into their own, commercially and artistically. The whole album has a clear, crisp sound and a new sheen of consummate professionalism that really gives the songs a big boost. He's been compared to Elvis Costello, but I think Huey has a far more bitter, cynical sense of humor.
Hey, Abstract.
Yes, Alan?
Why are there copies of the style section all over the place? Do you have a dog? A little chow or something?
No, Alan.
Is that a raincoat?
Yes, it is. In 87, Huey released this. Four, their most accomplished album. I think their undisputed masterpiece is Hip to Be Square. A song so catchy, most people probably don't listen to the lyrics. But they should, because it's not just about the pleasures of conformity and the importance of trends. It's also a personal statement about the band itself. Hey, Paul!
Light.
welcome back.
Hi.
What an absolute pleasure to be resuming Picture of the Month Club after all these months without a picture.
Sorry to everyone who likes Picture of the Month Club for missing it. But I had the biggest gig of my life. I became a dad.
So. I know. Congratulations. That's like a big life-changing thing.
Yeah, but that's not as exciting as talking about a movie.
I am so excited for this movie. Dutch, I worked in a video store at the time I was graduating from college, right? And I took this movie home and I watched it over and over again, maybe like 4 or 5 times. And then did not rewatch the whole film until yesterday. So 20 years in between, roughly 20 years in between viewings. And I learned some things about myself that we're going to get into tonight.
So, oh boy. Yeah. That's really funny. I also, college dropout, but when I was in college, I worked in a DVD boutique.
Which yes.
We might have covered on the show at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also where I got my hands on a copy of American Psycho. And also, I went home and I didn't watch it 20 times immediately, but I did watch it several times. And then I was at a bad habit or a good habit. I think it's a good habit. I used to burn like 12 or 13 DVDs from the DVD gallery that I worked at a time. I feel like I always say this on every show, but I've watched this movie, I feel like, 20 times.
I want to know, first of all, why you selected it. This was your choice.
Well, we were going through a list. We made a list.
We did.
Full disclosure.
Yeah, like 2 years worth of films.
I think so. Maybe not that many, but at least
a year.
I'm going to say definitely a year. There's at least 12 because it's a monthly club that we're running here.
Yeah.
But I think we landed somewhere around like 16 movies. And I think it's a good jumping off point. I will probably like swap some of them out or move the order around because we didn't really actually even make an order.
No.
I think it's really funny. About a month ago, I have a nephew who's in college. He always asked me what movies to watch. And, you know, he's basically hit that age where I can just recommend anything to him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was really funny because this was such a college movie for me. And I've been out of college for like almost 18 years now.
Yeah.
Or maybe not that long, maybe 15 years. And here he is, he's in his second year, and his dorm mate or one of his guys on his baseball team or something is like, oh my God, you haven't seen American Psycho? You have to watch it. And like, he watched it with like a room of like 15 other people who are all watching this movie for the first time. And it's obviously for like a, you know, smaller independent film is a film that's A, stuck around, and B, like maintained this level of popularity. I feel like this is a movie a lot of people who are kind of into movies at even like a base level of you pay attention to like what comes out at Sundance maybe, or you're just like not afraid to turn on like, you know, a smaller independent movie or a movie that's kind of older that you've always heard about. And and this one's kind of lasted its way through. So I feel like there's probably a sizable audience that's a cross section of your audience that has seen, not only seen, but also enjoys this film.
Indeed. I think it's worth mentioning too, since we're talking about people watching it now, the movie came out in 2000. It was based on a book written in 1991 by Bret Easton Ellis. It is based in 1987, which I think is a very interesting choice, in and around Wall Street. The sizable stock market crash follows the year, I think within a year of the time this film takes place, right? And so that's kind of looming over it, whether you're reading the book in 1991 or you're watching the movie in 2000. If you know your Wall Street history, that's like one thing that is in your mind throughout the film is that, you watch these people's behavior, you watch their lifestyles, and you just have this subtle awareness that a crash is coming for them, which I think is an interesting backdrop to this movie.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that the other cultural backdrop of it is like, it's a, to start this conversation off, but also in the realm of keeping it in the conversation of movies, is like, this is post, if I'm not mistaken, and if I am mistaken, we'll just edit this out.
Okay.
It is post Wall Street, the film. No?
The setting, the time the movie is set?
Yeah, 1987.
I believe that was the year that Wall Street came out. So no one evidences any awareness of the film Wall Street, but it was, yes, coming out, I think, right around this time that the movie takes place.
Yeah, and I think that it kind of informs this, like, a little bit of this world of, like, yuppie culture and this problem Oliver Stone kind of talked about, which was in regards to Wall Street and Gordon Gekko and his whole greed is good thing. Mm-hmm. Is he kind of has publicly kind of stated that he laments how many people saw that movie, especially impressionable young men, mm-hmm. and walked away with it loving and wanting to be Gordon Gekko.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that a lot of the, like, even if the movie came out after the book takes place or whatever it is, I think that this is like that kind of generation of those young men, sort of like in the way that you had a great many people watch The Wolf of Wall Street and want to be Jordan
Belfort.
That is the culture that the movie's kind of steeped in. That is like the cultural milieu, like that of the yuppie and that of like a world of like hyper materialism in a sense.
All right. I will see your disturbing social trend influenced by Hollywood and raise you one. This movie actually inspired, like, there was a magazine that put out like a whole Patrick Bateman photo shoot, like how to dress like Patrick Bateman. I think it was some years after the movie too, like revisiting, like, these are the restaurants that these guys went to. This was the scene they were a part of, almost glamorizing this story, I think mostly from a fashion sense, but also extending it to lifestyle in general. So that happened too.
Wild.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was as much of a satire as this movie is trying to be.
Yeah.
Or is. I should say it is. I mean, I think personally the movie is just like 100%. It's a satirical dark comedy.
I agree. Without giving away some of the paths we're going to go down in the show, can you do a quick rundown on the plot?
Sure. It's a movie that doesn't have the strongest like plot structure. And I don't know, a quick question. Have you read the book?
I have not read the book, but in preparation for the show, I did manage to find some chapters of the book on YouTube in audiobook form. So I listened to one of them just to get a sense of the difference. The book is long for what it is. I mean, this is a movie that's about an hour and 40 minutes, and I think it's like a 400-page book. Yeah. And obviously, Ellis in the book has to be fairly long-winded with his explanations of so much of what we can see in the movie. Like, he will describe what everybody is wearing, you know, where even though Patrick, that our protagonist here, Patrick, pays very close attention to what everybody is wearing and what everybody is doing, you know, Ellis has to go a step further in the book. So the book is actually pretty laborious, and it also gives a little bit more backstory. Like, Patrick's mother appears in the book. Yep. Another ex-girlfriend appears in the book. He writes her a poem.
There's way more murders in it. I mean, I gotta say, it's I think one of the strongest adaptations. Like, I read the book, I've seen the movie, I love the book, I love the movie, but I think that visually the movie was able to kind of encapsulate like what the book was about, and like I think that it held the movie held the book's tone through and through. Like, I believe there's at least one, maybe like three chapters in the book that are just Patrick Bateman describing possessions that he has in his apartment.
Oh, yeah. And like Huey Lewis in the News gets a chapter. Phil Collins gets a chapter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which all goes in. All right. So but we'll get into that and like why that's important. But I guess the basic plot in the movie is like Patrick Bateman is this character, or a basic description is like, I think it's basically like, it's a satirical dark comedy that's like a character study based around this character, Patrick Bateman, who is a 1980s Wall Street yuppie who's vice president of this company, who has this kind of like very, very kind of pitch perfect like image of himself. Mm-hmm. And by day, he's kind of like this debonair, handsome, super powerful, really wealthy Wall Street trader. And by night, he is a serial killer. Mm-hmm. And the movie is like Patrick trying to like navigate this world between these two versions of himself, One is which he is this like kind of perfect, almost like yuppie archetype, and the other where he is a literal serial murderer.
Well, yeah, we'll see what happens as we unfold our story here. Point of clarification for people who are unfamiliar with Wall Street jargon. When you said that he is a vice president, it should be known that at this time, every 20-something mid-level guy working at an investment firm was called vice president. That actually relates to one of the themes of the movie that we're going to talk about today as well. Like, when they all like when you see their business cards and you will see their business cards, they all say vice president. So where do we want to begin?
Great question.
With themes, because there are so many roads we could go down here.
I guess I kind of started one, not only like a thematic element, but it's also like one of the strongest visual hinges of the movie that's even reflected in its poster. Which is something that we've never done on the show, is like talk about how a poster is like illuminating a theme of a movie, right?
I love it. I love it. Let's do it.
So basically the theme is that there's like they split between, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is almost like Lacan, right? Where it's like there is like the image of a human being and then the one that they portray and put forth.
Yeah.
And then there is like the inner person and the subconscious person and like the true self that is basically hidden by this veneer. There's a couple of scenes that I kind of wanted to hit on when talking about this. And the other thing that I want to talk about with this is the poster of the film. And I think that this is like Mary Harron, the director, does a great job with this. I'll talk about the scene first. So the first scene of the movie, past the credits, opens up. And it's like, I think it's like a New Order song that's playing.
Mm-hmm.
This like club, and there's these like Charlie's Angels kind of characters, and there's all these like weird characters buying drugs and total 80s Friday night yuppie extravaganza in like a really hip looking club.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're introduced to Patrick Bateman. Patrick Bateman goes to the bar and he offers some kind of ticket, and the bartender says, "We don't accept these anymore. This is a cash bar only."
Mm-hmm.
And he is very, you know, very done up. He's in his suit. He's in his jacket. Smiles at her very warmly, very politely. Says, "Of course." Gives her $25. I think he's like very polite. Says, "Thank you." This and that. Right. The bartender turns to go get his drinks. So there's a shot of the bartender, and then there's a shot of Patrick Bateman as he's speaking to the bartender. Bartender leaves, and she goes towards the bar to make the drink.
Yeah.
As she goes back to the bar to make the drink, then we have a new shot. And in this new shot is a shot of the mirror behind the bar.
Yes.
With Patrick Bateman's reflection in it. Except for this time, when Patrick Bateman speaks, he is not being polite.
"You're a fucking ugly bitch. I want to stab you to death and then play around with your blood."
She comes back, not hearing any of these horrible things that he said to her, gives him the drinks, he smiles, says thank you, and that whole sequence is done, right?
Yeah.
And I think that what the movie is establishing off the bat, which we can go all the way to the ending with this, which is a thing that we definitely have to talk about, because I think it's a thing that too many people are questioning, always wind up questioning, like, did this thing happen or did that thing happen? Was this real? Was that fake? All of the answers to like the end of the movie, I think, come in that first scene, which is to the audience and to Patrick, to that bartender, right? These two sides of Patrick Bateman are indistinguishable, and that they can't, the version of him in the mirror and the version of him talking to the bartender, right? We never really know which part of it is the reality of the world that we're in.
Right.
Because even in that scene, in that self, is like, you can ask, did Patrick actually say all of those horrible things? Or is this just his mirror reflection version of itself, right?
Yeah.
If we're entering this movie as we're kind of becoming closer into the mind of this character, those two things are completely indistinguishable from each other. Patrick can never really distinguish the world of reality versus the world. His mirror image that he's putting forth and the one that's inside, did he, like, he couldn't be able to answer the question, did he actually say those words or didn't he?
So right from the jump off, we, audience, are asking ourselves, is this a reliable narrator?
I think you could. I don't think you really are at that point, because you haven't really taken, you know, you're just still kind of gathering information. But yeah. I think this is kind of one of those things that are in a rewatching or a discussion in the context of the whole film. The thing that actually stood out to me the most when revisiting this film is how strong that is set up, this kind of mirror image of oneself, the inner person versus the outer person, and how much the movie is going to be about our character not being able to distinguish the two.
Okay. So on the first viewing, you could, it's a clue, right? But you could just chalk it up as, hey, it's a noisy bar. People don't hear everything that's said, and you don't really know what's going on yet. It's not, you know, too much further along in the film where somebody, you know, they're sitting in another like club scene and he's talking about what he does. And he says to the woman, I'm into mergers and executions, right? And she hears mergers and acquisitions and starts asking him about that. Yep. So you kind of interpret it as this playfulness, but then you're actually starting to wonder, the more occurrences there are of him trying to assert this identity, and it's just rejected by everybody he tries to assert it to, it runs throughout the entire film.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think in the beginning of the film, you know, we don't know... Like, we're, as an audience, upon first viewing, you're not in the position to know if he, it's almost like you have to accept that, yes, he did stand at that bar and say those words, right? Where he said, I want to cut you open and play with your blood.
Yeah.
But I don't think our character really knows. I guess it's like, to your question of I think you said a good narrator or trustworthy narrator.
Yeah.
I think that from the jump street of the movie, that is kind of the question, right? Is like you can kind of go either way, which you can the entirety of the film, on whether he actually said what he said in the bar and she didn't hear him, or that this was inner monologue. It starts with that scene and that carries through to the entirety of the film, to the very end of the film, where you are actually asking yourself that same question.
It's interesting too, because after that first nightclub scene, he's back in the mirror talking to us, the audience, doing his morning routine. And in fact, I think the next reflection you see is like he's peeing. It's in the morning and he goes to the toilet and we're looking at his face as he does this voiceover. And he's kind of looking at himself in a Les Mis poster.
Yep.
Which is interesting, right? It's kind of a, they use it in the film as like a bit of a status symbol, like they're going to Les Mis.
Yes.
And when you think about like what the story is actually about, it's there's an irony there.
Yeah, that's the satirical.
Exactly. I mean,
those are one of the satirical elements of the film. But I think that you're kind of hitting the nail on the head, much like the movie is, right? Is like you go from image of Patrick in a mirror, and then you go into his apartment, and the next image you see is Patrick in a mirror. Right. And he's giving this whole intern, which kind of sets up the language, if you will, of like the movie, of like the mirror self is going to reveal to you what they actually are thinking, doing. And this movie has a ton of voiceover. Is he talking to us or is he talking to himself? Is he revealing his inner self? Right. And it's like shot of him in the mirror, shot of him in the shower, shot of him in the mirror again, putting on all of his beauty products. And then he has this, like, the really iconic shot, I think, of the movie, which is he puts on this, like, face mask thing.
There is an idea of a Patrick Bateman, some kind of abstraction, but there is no real me, only an entity, something illusory. And though I can hide my cold gaze, and you can shake my hand and feel flesh gripping yours, and maybe you can even sense our lifestyles are probably comparable, I simply am not there.
But that whole sequence basically takes place from the very introduction of the character to, I don't know, 5 minutes into the movie.
Yeah.
It's all done playing through mirrors.
Right.
Which is precisely, I think, the theme that's trying to be established. I think really actually successfully is established in those first 5 minutes, 6 minutes, and continues to run on for for the rest of the movie. It's a brilliant opening. Like, the opening of the movie is really, really well done, and it's so strong.
Right. And I think it's also the part where you, as the audience, you learn that this is supposed to be like playful, satirical, and amusing. And that was actually one thing that I noticed when I rewatched it after all these years, is the impact that this film actually had. I mean, I watched it like a handful of times as an impressionable 22, 23, somewhere around there, like done with college. And I'm seeing this movie. And I think I learned a lot about dark comedy from this film. You know, I do this other podcast. It's a comedy show. I do it with a couple of friends here. I think it is just absolutely delightful to torture a story about ourselves that's really about nothing, that nobody else should care about. Like, I took one show note into one of our recent episodes. It said mayo, like mayonnaise. And my goal was to talk about my use of mayonnaise for an hour. I learned that from this film, right? Because the other two guys I do the show with, they might be like, here, I'm here to report about my actual life. But I kind of do it as a character that is like verging on like a narcissistic psychosis. I think that's a funnier thing to do, you know, and just tell these long, elaborate stories that nobody should care about with the greatest passion in the world. I learned that from watching this movie. That's what I realized when I rewatched it.
Like, entire chapters of the book that are just dedicated to like where he got his furniture from and what it is and who made it and how much it's worth and his stereo system and going into like these really great banal details that like you only could with like that level of complete and utter narcissism. And I think like the reason that the movie works, and this might be just like leaping ahead too far, but it's like even though it is satirical, it works as its comedy works almost because it's so believable.
Mm-hmm.
As in like Patrick Bateman as that character, as that entity, as that person that can have that level of narcissism and self-importance and self-worth is actually in a lot of ways like a character that you can relate to, in as much as that you would detest that person, in that you probably see an image of other people in your life that you would think are that narcissistic.
Oh, absolutely. And it plays great for comedy, but it reveals something very, very sad in the story, right? The prioritization of, I guess we could say, image over identity. And we start to see like why this film might hit harder today than it did 20 years ago, where people in every opportunity they're given, Patrick and just about every other character, and this relates to it too, because so many of the characters are basically interchangeable. Right? Yep. Everybody looks the same. Everybody at every like named character, just about every named male character in the movie that works at this Pierce and Pierce firm gets mistaken for somebody else who works there, which is obviously a significant part of the plot of the movie as well. Patrick gets mistaken for Marcus Halberstam. There's disagreement over who Paul Allen is. Patrick is referred to as maybe four or five different people.
And even towards the end of the movie, a doorman, a nighttime doorman.
Mm-hmm.
It really reaches such an awesome pitch in this movie. But like towards like the climax of the film, where Patrick is running around in the street, just like shooting everything. Not to jump ahead too crazy far, but too late, I did. He enters essentially the wrong building, which he can confuse where he lives, right? Which this is like a major building that has like, I forget what floor he lives on, but he details it in it's like one of the first things that he says in the movie. He lives on like the 54th floor of this building on Central Park West or whatever it is. So he lives in this massive building that he confuses. He enters the wrong building because he can't tell the difference between his building and the one next to it.
Mm-hmm.
He walks through the lobby. He sees the midnight like doorman and he goes, "Ah, good evening, Mr. Smith." And then he just completely realizes that not only is he in the wrong building, that he can't distinguish like his residence from another huge skyscraper, but also that this midnight doorman has like self-assuredly identified him as completely the wrong person.
Right.
And so he shoots him in the head and he runs across this plaza to another building with another that looks absolutely identical almost in every way. Gets to the different doorman and he realizes he's in the right building and he just signs himself in. You can watch the movie, but it's almost like an earnest mistake. I think it's like Paul Allen, the character played by Jared Leto.
Yep.
Is the first person, even if that is his character's actual name, because nobody knows who anybody is because nobody has no identity, right? Just that mirror identity, the thing that they push out, which is all about their material possessions.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, we'll get to that scene. Everybody's favorite scene is the business card scene.
Yeah.
But Paul Allen immediately thinks that he's somebody else. And you can almost think that this is like this, almost an earnest mistake as an audience member, right? Because all these guys do kind of like look the same in a certain sense.
Yeah. And he even points that out, like, Allen has confused me with this
dickhead, Marcus Halberstram. It seems logical because Marcus also works at PNP and in fact does the same exact thing I do. He also has a penchant for Valentino suits and Oliver Peoples glasses. Marcus and I even go to the same barber, although I have a slightly better haircut.
So how's the ransom account going, Marcus?
It's all right.
Really? That's interesting. It's not great.
Oh, well, you know.
So how's Cecilia? She's a great girl.
Oh, yeah. I'm very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Alan. Congratulations on the Fisher account.
Thank you, Baxter.
Listen, Paul, squash.
Call me.
What, Friday?
No can do. I got an 8:30 res at Dorsia. Great. Sea urchin ceviche.
But yeah. It's just earlier in the movie where Patrick and his circle of friends are in some restaurant and they're having a disagreement over who Paul Allen is, right? Yep. They go, that's Paul Allen over there. They all work. They like all visit the same boardroom together.
Yep. I think Justin Theroux's character says that's Paul Allen over there. And Patrick Bateman says, no, that's not Paul Allen because he's not wearing X brand.
Right.
And
yeah.
And that's how they can distinguish essentially who the person is, because there's nothing underneath the surface of any of these people, which is like, you know, the great kind of the bigger picture satire of the movie. These are like all these like empty hollow shells inside. But yeah, I mean, the movie goes from like that, which like early scene of like not being able to distinguish characters between each other, to the boardroom where they're looking at the business cards and Jared Leto's character gets him confused for Halberstram, where it's almost like these circumstances are like, they're increasingly so done in a way where they almost become like more and more and more blatant. Right. Yeah. So like the first time you see it, when they're in the lounge, they're looking at somebody across the room. And then when it happens to Patrick Bateman, Jared Leto puts his hand on his shoulder. Right. And it's like this closer thing. And then like by the time you get to that sequence at the end of the movie where he's running through the apartment building, it's like a character who's looking at him face to face in an empty hotel or an empty apartment building lobby. There's no one around. There's no one to mistake it. There's no one to mistake him for, and completely calls him Mr. Smith, which is also like the most generic name on the face of the earth. Right.
Yeah.
Which is like this nobody kind of hollow vessel that you could get confused for. And then basically the next or another couple scenes away where Patrick's own lawyer
calls him Davis. Yeah.
Davis. Yeah. You have the mirror image, which is false, right? Which is nothing. And like the only like version that Patrick knows of himself is the one that we hear the inner dialogue of, that deeper under the surface person who is this like horrid and horrible murderous psychopath.
But while he's letting us, the audience, into that, it's very, very clear through everything that he tells us that all that matters to him about him is what we think of him, right?
Correct.
Which is kind of, like, we'll just preview this now, how he ends the film in his own personal hell.
Yep.
So that's it for today. If you want to hear the rest of this episode of Picture of the Month Club and all other episodes of Picture of the Month Club, plus have access to episodes of The Discomfort Zone, In Pursuit of Utopia, and all other bonus content that we've created since 2016, and most importantly, to incentivize and support the continued creation of content that I know for a fact thousands of people have found very enriching and liberating. And this would include the six pillars of self-esteem, the Trivium, the principles of learning anything, Logic Saves Lives, our series on creativity, our series on memory, our series on procrastination.
Speed in Politics, Presence in Productivity, and so many more individual shows that have alerted people to the problems of public school and higher education, even though a majority of what we do is talk about solutions, like how to become a better learner and a better critical thinker, how to develop as a person, how to gain self-knowledge, and of course, how to discover and pursue superior options when it comes to both learning and emotional health. That's what we do. Please go to patreon.com/schoolsucks. Sign up to contribute $1 per content item. That usually works out to about an $8 a month commitment. Now, our operation survives and thrives on a voluntary value exchange, which is if you think that the podcast that I put out for free provides you value, your family value, contributes positively to the larger messages of the philosophy of liberty or self-directed education, if you're in the affirmative on all that, I ask you to help us keep this operation going and growing with your support. So, I would love to give all this stuff away for free, but that wouldn't be fair to the people who help us out so much. I hope you will consider doing that. The show has been around for 10 years, and right now our like daily download numbers look better than ever. I have done some outreach recently. I've made some new connections. My yesterday, which was Wednesday, because I'm recording this on Thursday to release it to you on Friday, I was on Part of the Problem with Dave Smith. The interview went very, very well. And already, like looking at the numbers over the course of the year so far, I'm seeing daily download numbers I've never seen before, and that's great. But I have a feeling it's about to grow a lot more at a more rapid rate than it has since maybe 2009 or 2010. So this is a moment where I could really use your help. I'm not asking you for donations. You support this show as a signal to me that the podcast provides you value. In exchange for that, you get bonus content that is actually worth listening to. We are not dicking around, just throwing up anything that doesn't make it into the podcast as finger quotes bonus content. I'm being very, very judicious because I know your time is valuable. I try to demonstrate consistently that I value your time while so many other podcasters and YouTubers and bloggers are competing for your time. And to offer you extra content, I'm going to make sure that it is of a very, very high quality and it is consistent with, I think, what a lot of people appreciate about the style of School Sucks Productions. So that's what's happening. This is not donate to us. This is not Amazon wishlist. I got rid of the Amazon wishlist. Amazon wishlists are for Instagram butt models. And I think what we're doing, even though it's less appreciated generally, is far more important than butt modeling. And also, podcasting is forever, right? We are creating as permanent a record as there can be of these ideas, which is another reason why I think the quality is so important. But if we are going to continue to level up like we did in a lot of ways in 2019, I really need your support. For everything that I want to do that I cannot do, the obstacle right now is money. And it is very, very common when media creators ask for some form of support or voluntary value exchange, people listening say the other person will do it. If you are still listening to my voice right now, you are the other person. The link again is patreon.com/schoolsucks. Thank you very much.